The 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 276, a panel discussion, Cross Currents, the Mormon Community, 1993-94.
We are missing one of our panelists today, and I have called his home, and they tell me that he was planning on being here, so that is why we are starting a little bit late. And in order to pull out the time a bit for him in which to arrive, we're going to turn the time over first to Aaron Silva, who has an announcement for the Alliance.
For serious post-conference... No. I'll read it exactly the way Levina gave it to me. I'm under instructions to do this. Play-by-play post-conference discussion for Sirius Conference watchers. October 3rd, 1994, Maine Public Library, 6:30 to 8:30. Come and watch conference with us. It's really a lot of fun.
Oh,
you laugh. I'm telling you, it can be a great amount of fun. So, yeah, 6:30 to 8:30, October 3rd, at the Maine Public Library. Where will we be? Upstairs?
Yeah, third floor.
That third floor where we've been before.
Auditorium.
The auditorium.
Conference
and make fun of everything.
No, we don't! Aaron, please just off. There are parts of it that we take very seriously. As I recall, when we watched conference this last April, we all very much liked Elder Hunter's talk.
That's about it.
I'm not that old.
Marty?
All right. We are now ready to begin. Our last panelist has arrived. And I am very briefly going to introduce our panelists. I'll start at the far end. Actually, should I... There are three in the middle that have given me biographies, and the two on each end say, you know us.
Well, I just forgot.
Paul Toscano is the father of four daughters. And what I would like to have Paul tell us right now as an introduction, take the mic, and tell us precisely what it is that his daughters wrote to him in their dedication of he and his wife's book, Strangers in Paradox.
I can't remember, and I don't want to, even if I could, I probably wouldn't do it because it might embarrass my daughters, who some of whom are here. But I am the father of four daughters, and Margaret and I wrote Strangers in Paradox. I just finished publishing The Sanctity of Dissent, which is available, I think, here. I think some of you may know that... I was released from my membership in the church not without a vote of thanks. But as I consider myself a saint in exile, which is this doesn't look too much like exile to me though, and I thank you for your support.
Vicki Stewart, she grew up in Salt Lake. She moved back 1 year ago after many years in Northern California. A graduate of Stanford University, she works as an independent executive recruiter, also known as a headhunter, with particular emphasis on biotechnology, high technology, and apparel industries. So if anybody out there is looking for a new job, you may want to contact her. A single mother of four with one son on a mission, she feels very much like she moved into ground zero of religious turmoil when she found she had moved into the very ward and stake that had excommunicated Paul Toscano. In fact, she was heard to remark to her cat, "Tika, I don't think we're in California anymore." Fred Voris was a member of the third class, I just discovered, of Brigham Young University, the first in the official building.
Law school. Not the university.
Oh! Yes, not the university building. He is now practicing law, does defense work for the Utah Attorney General's criminal defense and appeals more, not defense, criminal appeals for the Utah Attorney General's office. He is the author of a children's book, The Stones of the Temple, and he's a trustee of the Mormon Alliance. In some circles, not a recommendation. Sonia Farnsworth is not an attorney, alas. Jeez, there's only two at this table. Graduate student in communications. There's four of us that are attorneys at this table, two who are not. Sonia Farnsworth, she's a graduate student in communications. She's a feminist. She's a stay-at-home mom. And she's an author. She's the author of Mormonism's Odd Couple, The Mother-Priesthood Connection in Women and Authority. Doug Bates is the one on this panel that I have the distinction of having known the longest. I remember more years ago than I care to count attending his daughter's birthday party in Kansas City, Missouri. He's a lawyer. He presently works for the state of Utah. He's a father of three and grandfather of six. I missed this last. He said he's a Sunday school teacher in Salt Lake, and then the next line says, county jail. And, mark of distinction, a former Fuller Brush salesman. The format of our panel is fairly simple. We have attempted, to the best of our ability, to ask people to speak who have very different perspectives on the issues that will be discussed. Fred Voris will narrate, and none of the people involved have prepared statements. This is a comment as it comes. And I will now turn the time over and the direction over to Fred.
Thank you. Welcome to our Cross Currents panel. Totally unrehearsed, totally spontaneous,
totally live.
We are going to talk about a lot of issues today, and not necessarily in depth, but we hope we will have an interesting interchange on them. Issue one. Scholars and feminists and gays, oh my. On May 18, 1993, Elder Packer gave a talk to the All-Church Coordinating Committee, which is a group made up of department heads and senior personnel in the church office building. In it, he said, and I quote, "Three dangers that have made major invasions into the membership of the church." He listed these as, quote, "the gay-lesbian movement, the feminist movement, and the ever-present challenge from the so-called scholars or intellectuals," close quote. These invasions are, quote, "of an intensity and seriousness that we have not faced before." Question, are these groups, gay-lesbians, feminists, and scholars or intellectuals, exerting pressure on the church to drift from revealed values? Sonia?
No, I think they're trying to move the church towards revealed values and that the church has drifted from revealed values. I think, for example, in terms of feminism, the church has a sense that somehow it's present condition in terms of women is eternal, but evidence indicates that it wants to promote the middle class family, wants to promote middle class values, and these values were just sort of created in 1850. All this stuff that the church is saying about this is ideological stuff that's developed since then and has very little bearing on the lives of women today, and also is not Mormon doctrine. But the church insists that things about middle-class values, family values, and all that stuff is Mormon doctrine. So I would say that in terms of feminism, at least, feminism is trying to bring the church in line with its early Mormon history and with some of the basic notions of Christianity, which are just fairness and justice and love and charity.
What about the other groups? What about the gay lesbian movement? Well, I don't think that the church has any revelation on this subject, and rather than just come out with commandments and prejudices of the past, it seems to me that revelation is in order, and like Jake Golden Kimball said about Heber J. Grant, I wish the hell to get on the job, because if unless you get revelation on these questions, I mean, new social issues come up, they have to be addressed, revelation is needed, but what we get really isn't revelation, but a harking back to Old Testament views that I think are more or less outmoded. If Christ dies and made of all nations one blood, then I think we have to review and revisit all of our prejudices and all of our past assumptions about things, and we're just refusing to do that and want to retreat into Old Testament kinds of attitudes about these issues, which I think doesn't serve us well.
Could I make a comment? The part about that particular talk that really upset me was sparked off by an incident that occurred several months later at the Salt Lake City Library, where a gunman took a bunch of hostages and held them there in the library, just random hostages, and he wanted various demands aired. But one of them, the most significant to me, was that he felt that his place in society was being usurped by the feminists. It seems to me that the statement that was made by Elder Packer was really socially irresponsible in today's society. We live in a church and in a state, I have found, that is armed to the teeth, and there are a fair number of crazy people who would feel quite justified in eliminating the church's major enemies if they could. I don't know that, I really think that Elder Packer needs to reevaluate such strong language and such harsh labeling of groups in light of what could occur in a violence-prone society.
Does it make a difference that the talk was not given for public consumption? I mean, I have a copy of it. Other people have copies of it, but it was not given to the general public. Does that matter to you? Do you think there are chairs of department heads in the church who might be prone to this kind of violence?
I don't think they're the chairs of the department heads of the church necessarily. Whether he intended it for public consumption or not, it became public consumption because it was printed in the newspaper.
Doug?
Wait, I have something to say.
Okay, what do you have to say, Sonia?
Well, I don't know now.
You don't have a gun in your purse or anything. Whatever, you just speak as long as you'd like.
I think that just because the talk wasn't for public consumption, it's very reflective of a mood in the church. May not have even begun with Elder Packer himself, but there's a mood and a philosophy around that the talk was meant to sort of percolate down to the leaders on the lower levels of the church, and then it was hoped, I guess, to send the message on to the ones on to the general membership. So in what way does it matter whether the talk was meant for public consumption or whether it actually did go out? That attitude is alive and well in the church, and it was before Elder Packer said it. In fact, I think Elder Packer is inspired by, you know, is almost inspired by general ideas on the earth more than he is by general ideas in heaven.
Amen.
Oh, you didn't want to say it.
Yeah, I want to hear from Doug.
Well, so far, three people don't think that there's any threat from these three movements. Of course, maybe we're part of the so-called intellectual movement, I guess. Doug, do you see there anything threatening? And if so, what's the threat and what's the threat to?
Well, I think there is a big difference between something that's meant for private consumption in a group and something that's meant for public consumption. I think all of us say things within our families where we're discussing personal matters or viewpoints in our families that relate to the setting of the family and the assumptions within the family that wouldn't necessarily relate outside, because the people outside are lacking the foundation for the things that are being said. Whether Brother Packer knew that was going to be made public, I don't know. I don't know what he had in his mind when he made those statements. Whether those groups are moving the church away from Revelation or towards Revelation or within Revelation, I think there are probably a lot of opinions about that also. But unless a person actually has had revelation as to that, I think it's a little bit presumptive, perhaps, to say that it's moving the church away from revelation. Or it may very well be that the church will, through revelation, move in that direction. In my youth, I know there were supposed revealed truths regarding the priesthood for the blacks. And were the people who were agitating then about that moving the church away from revelation or towards revelation or within the context of revealed truth? And the fact of the matter is that revelation finally came that established a new standard. And will that happen in this case with these three groups? I don't know. But I'm not ready to say at this point that the things that are that those groups are the positions that they're taking are necessarily pro-God or anti-God or anything else. I think God has to speak on it. I agree. There isn't really anything authoritative, specifically, thus saith the Lord, that's out there that I've seen.
I have to say this, Fred.
Okay.
As a person who studies rhetoric, I know that the ideas that Elder Packer expressed in this talk are common American ideas that have been expressed many, many times before in many forums. They now come under the heading of conservative, perhaps. And I don't mean to dismiss conservative thought in saying that, but I do mean to say that they are common secular notions. And as such, they themselves bring us away from the core of Mormon doctrine, which is radical and beautiful. And as such, his accusation that we are moving away, or feminists, homosexuals, and intellectuals are moving away, is ironic.
Someone has raised the question of whether the second mic is being recorded. And Vicki, could you go down to the registration area and find out?
It's not as loud. What you're talking about is louder.
Yeah. You can't hear? It'd be better to use just the one mic. Yeah. Second issue. The non-purge. In September of 1993, Lincoln Ava Whitesides was disfellowshipped for speaking on women in the priesthood, God the Mother, and other feminist issues. Avraham Gileadi was excommunicated for teaching false doctrine, being predatory in teaching his theology, and for believing dead prophets over living ones, according to the Sunstone Report. Paul Toscano was excommunicated for supposedly derogatory remarks about Elder Russell Nelson in his symposium paper entitled All Is Not Well in Zion, False Teachings of the True Church. Maxine Hanks was excommunicated for, quote, conduct contrary to the laws and order of the church, close quote, apparently speaking against the church's ban on the ordination of women. Levina Fielding Anderson was excommunicated for apostasy, that is, for refusing to stop chronicling incidents that she felt, and many others have felt, were ecclesiastical abuse. Michael Quinn was excommunicated for, quote, apostasy and conduct unbecoming a member, close quote. His stake president cited the Dialogue article on post-manifesto polygamy, a Sunstone article on the church's tendency to kill the messenger, and some statements to the press to the effect that church leaders wanted, quote, cookie-cutter Mormons. Later in the year, David Wright, a faculty member at Brandeis University, was excommunicated for arguing that critical examination of the Book of Mormon compels the conclusion that, while it may be inspired, it is not of ancient origin. Michael Barrett, assistant legal counsel to the CIA, was excommunicated for writing letters to the editor that were, quote, embarrassing to the church. For example, he wrote that the 1978 reversal of the ban on black priests, quote, implicitly labeled three of our prophets as purveyors of false doctrine, close quote. These disciplinary actions were reported in the New York Times, the LA Times, CNN, and National Public Radio, among others. Bearing in mind that this is a church of nearly 9 million members, did we or did we not see a purge?
We definitely saw a purge. What is interesting to me is that people outside of the Wasatch Front were having a hard time getting any information at all. Actually, people here on the Wasatch Front who subscribe to the Deseret News were basically getting no information at all also. I spent most of many mornings faxing news articles down to California to keep people abreast of the news down there. I felt it was simply a stunning blow to the intellectual movement, or, I don't know, alternative voices. It was like a kick in the stomach. I have never felt anything so awful. I moved into this ward, and 2 months later, it was my stake president that was on the news, my stake president that was in the papers, people that I knew were being excommunicated, and I found myself at a lot of vigils holding candles and singing hymns better than I've ever sung them in my life. I think we've started a new art form, really. I feel that it was a purge because the weight of the members, sometimes you count people and sometimes you weigh people. And the weight of these people, the impact of these people was much greater than their numbers. I would, however, like to have Paul, if he wouldn't mind. I don't know, maybe you don't feel comfortable. He doesn't mind. When I was down in California defending the people who had been excommunicated, I received a number of comments that Paul in particular had really become outrageous, and that the talk that he was specifically cited for had truly crossed over the mark. And I was able to give people down there some information that they may not have known, and perhaps you don't know, about why that was quite as extreme as it was. Would you feel comfortable relating the background behind that?
I wouldn't mind, but I'm not sure I follow the thread of what you want me to say.
I would see. It was so obscure. It was regarding the movement against Margaret.
Oh, yeah.
Well, what happened originally, you know, I get tagged as one of the September 6th, but it started out that, of course, Margaret was the one who was targeted for discipline. And that was going forward full bore because she had several meetings with Carrie Hines, and it looked like in our last meeting it wasn't going to work out because we just couldn't reach a reconciliation. Our Bishop Wilson Martin had been involved, and he's a good man, Wilson, and he's been helpful, but he was trying to negotiate some kind of a resolution of it. And I won't go into all the details of that, but there was a point at which Carrie Hines' attention was diverted from Margaret to me. And that, I think, was a result probably of just my temperament. I'm a little bit more volatile I probably insulted him is what happened. And Margaret is a lot nicer person, even though we agree on everything. And I think the result was that he went after me largely because I basically ran through the field holding a red flag, and the kind of the bull caught the side of that and went after me. And basically, I'm a Mediterranean personality. I say what's on my mind. I raise my voice. I yell back at him and point out things that sometimes he doesn't like to be reminded of. And in those discussions when that happened, I think he formed the opinion that I was essentially a bad person because I, rather than go into depression like most Mormons do, I will display my anger, and then I go home, and then I go into depression. The reality was that it shifted. I have no idea why Margaret was not tried with me. I think it was because Carrie felt that she should be handled by Wilson Martin, our bishop, because she's a woman, and it's in the bishop's jurisdiction, and he has not been willing to go forward. And I think that after it was all over, I think everybody was pretty much nauseated by the whole process, leaders and me and our family alike. So it just kind of bogged down and nothing's been done. I don't think that that's where it will stay, but that's what happened. And just my view, I think it is a purge, but let me say this, that I do not believe that Elder Packer orchestrated it. I think if he had been orchestrating it, it wouldn't have all happened in September. I think what he failed to count upon was that the people that they now choose as stake presidents and above are able to anticipate counsel. So the slightest suggestion that somebody needs to be removed or disciplined is all that it takes for them to put the disciplinary counsel machinery into action. And so I think what Brother Packer failed to do was was to put some time constraints on the various stake presidents that he might have talked to say, well, you know, don't excommunicate, for heaven's sake, don't excommunicate them all in the same month because it'll look like a purge. And
But get it done by October.
You know, and when I asked, and for the record, let me say that I asked Kerry Hines directly. I said, did Elder Packer tell you to excommunicate me? And he said, I met with Elder Packer. You wouldn't have known that unless Bishop Martin had told you. And I said, yes, but I do know it. And you did meet with him, and I want to know whether he told you to excommunicate me. And he said, no, he never directed me to excommunicate you. And I said, but wasn't the fair implication of his words to you, Kerry, that I should be excommunicated? And he said, yes, that was the fair implication of his words. And that was said in the presence of other people. So that was a direct quote from him. And, of course, as it came out later in the paper, they did have what they considered a philosophical discussion about this, but the philosophical discussion was really to go through the scriptures and to point out how I compare with the Book of Mormon character Korihor and and other things. Now, I admit that we might look alike. But one of the principal differences that I believe in Christianity, in Mormonism, and as I recall, Korihor didn't. So,
was it a purge? I could offer a different perspective. I mean, for how many years has Sunstone and Dialogue published articles critical of the church and the thought of the general authorities, and we've only got this little, you know, we have a small number now slowly being milked out of the church. Maybe I better rethink this. But I do think that you can also argue that the church has shown remarkable tolerance. It just finally stopped. And I'm hoping that the other aspect of this is that the excommunication process has been so simplified. All you have to do is be told not to do something and then do it. Now, the thing that you're told not to do has nothing to do with the Ten Commandments or any of the basic notions of Christianity, like don't commit adultery, so then you go out and commit it. Well, that would be something that you could be excommunicated for. But you say don't write a letter to the editor, and then you do it, and then you're excommunicated. That's kind of way off there. In terms of sin, it's sort of they've made the big sin into something that really doesn't apply. So I would say that there is a purge in the sense that we're sending a message to every single member of the church, and a purge is sort of a gigantic effect, and I think it has had a gigantic effect. But in terms of the church's ability to be tolerant, it has shown some patience and ability over the last 20 or 30 years.
If being outrageous is grounds for excommunication, having known Paul for 15 years, I'd say he qualifies because he's been outrageous from the first day I met him. So far as whether it's a purge when you're personally involved in something or one of your friends is personally involved, then it's always a dramatic and serious event. I'd submit that probably to the majority of members of the church, they're not even aware of it. And so for the majority of the church, no, it's not a purge. It's not even an event because they don't even know it happened. But I think to people here that have been closely involved with it, sure, to say it's a purge, that's not inaccurate because of your involvement and your close knowledge and your close friendship with those that were involved.
Issue number 3, follow the prophet's counselors. According to the Salt Lake Tribune, August 15, 1993, and I'm quoting, two certificates of authority filed in May 1989 gave absolute control over the corporation of the President of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to Counselors Gordon B. Hinckley and Thomas S. Monson. It is the first time since the corporation was founded 70 years ago that anyone other than the church president has obtained total authority over Utah's most powerful corporation. Steve Benson went public, as you well know, with his grandfather, President Benson's incapacity.
which was a rather stark contrast to official pronouncements that left the impression that President Benson was basically competent. President Hinckley has spoken of God's redundancy system, putting at least some of the saints at ease, perhaps, over this issue. Question. In a church that has staked so much on the prophet, how serious a problem is an incapacitated president, as we have seen in the past year? That is it serious enough to precipitate a change in the succession procedure?
Not necessarily. I think it's serious enough to precipitate a change in the way the leadership has tried to give the impression that the prophets are viable when in fact they're not. And I think that's the issue. I think after Steve Benson made his public stand on the issue, President Hinckley gave a talk about how the other quorums take over and that revelation can be received, which I think any normal, regular, red-blooded member of the church can understand and feel at peace about. The problem, I think, is that he didn't do this before. And so the problem can simply be solved by more honesty. I, on the other hand, do favor an idea of a prophet emeritus. And I'd be perfectly happy if somebody made a decision that the person in charge of the church, the prophet, was in such an infirm state that it would just be rude to ask him to do all the work that is required of a man in that position.
President Benson's not the first one, of course, that's been incapacitated, and anyone that's been a member through Brother Kimball's tenure or President McKay's tenure has experienced that also. As I recall, when I last attended conference and was asked to sustain the general authorities, there was more than one that was sustained as prophet, seer, and revelator. I don't get particularly cranked up about this one, but so far as the comment that President Benson was consulted, which Brother Hinckley said that Brother Benson was consulted and gave his assent, my dad just died in June. He would have been 91 this month. 5 years ago, he was in an automobile accident. A guy born the same day, same year as he was, ran into him with a car and bounced my dad on his head down the road, and it threw him into severe dementia. Where he had a real short cycle on his memory. He'd say, "Don't I have to go to work today?" This from a 90-year-old man. "No, dear, you've been retired now for 25 years." "Oh, retired? What are we living on? You're getting a pension. You're getting Social Security. How much do we have?" "Oh, about $1,000. "Oh, that's a lot of money. I'm glad we've got that. I was really worried." And then he'd look for a minute, maybe talk about something else, and about 90 seconds later, "Gee, I've got to go to work today." And he'd cycle back into that same thing, and it went like that hour after hour after hour. But occasionally, you could sit down with my dad if you were one of the blessed people that was there, and the old Luke Bates would emerge. He was a brilliant and a wonderful man. And you could talk to him, and he could speak with you lucidly and good reasoning and good thought. But anyone else that wasn't there at the time would say he's just a silly old fool that lost his mind. The Friday before he died, my nephew was over there that hadn't seen him for quite a while. My dad recognized him. He hasn't recognized me for years. Just like I don't recognize my kids. I call my wife honey, so I don't mess up on the name. It's not been one of my strengths with names, but my dad called this boy by name and sat and talked with him about the things he'd done, where he was going, and all of that. He remembered all of that, talked about the family. It was wonderful. Now, did that occur with President Benson? I don't know. Was his grandson correct in saying that he didn't know what was going on from day to day? Very likely he was. I don't have any doubt of that. And President Hinckley spoke of that on various occasions, even before all of this happened. It could well be that the grandson, every time he went there, that was the kind of experience. But was that the kind of experience Brother Hinckley had? I don't know. I wasn't there. I do know there were those blessed moments with my dad, And then there were the gray, dismal hours and days for the rest of the time that just ate away at all of us. And those of you that have had experience with older people know that, and I think we need to be a little bit less judgmental on those issues.
I've known Doug as long as he's known me, and he says that for as long as he's known me, I've been outrageous, and that's really true. For as long as I've known him, he's been sentimental. And sentimentality is what he's invoking now to cover up a real serious problem that we have in the church by invoking his father. It's very hard to use a personal anecdote like that and then have said that the apostles should seek the low places and not look to be honored. But to address the issue that he tries to cover over with this story, it is not that we should be intolerant of aged people or to be intolerant of our prophets when they get older. What we must be intolerant of is lying in the name of the Lord and putting forth policies of the church in the name of the president of the church when he has no mental capacity even to review them and to suggest that these things are coming from him. It would be much more forthright for the 12 apostles to state openly that they are governing the church by an apostolic interregnum rather than by letting that information circulate to us by indirection, which it did all for the past two or three years when official statement after official statement was issued, including the symposium statement, I think back in 1991, was not signed by the first presidency, but the council of the first presidency and the quorum of the 12, which is their code word for saying to us that the presidency of the church is not functioning independently from the council of the 12 and that the church is being run by an apostolic interregnum. That should be placed before the saints, and the saints should have an opportunity to vote on it and sustain them in that office. I don't fault them for running the church. They have the right to get revelation. I just fault them for not trusting us enough to be able to tell us that President Benson is too ill to deal with certain problems and that they're going to deal with them. Also, moving the church from a corporation sole organization under the laws of Utah to one where the corporation sole president is delegating that responsibility to somebody else may in fact be illegal, but it certainly deserves some kind of sustaining vote by the membership. It isn't to object to President Benson. It isn't even to object to his counselors running the church. It is that they feel, I think, that they have no accountability to the saints and no obligation to inform us about these internal decisions. They just run it, and then if we can find out about it, fine, but if we criticize, then we're going to get punished. I think that's what's at the root of this. It's the non-disclosure. Now, I've been thinking about the talk that's come up twice in these sessions of Sunstone, the prophet will not lead us astray. The idea is that if he did, before he would, I think the Lord would take him. I think that was the original intent of the statement to Parley P. Pratt as it has come down to us. I think some people interpret it to mean that the prophet can do no wrong, but most of us think, well, maybe it means that the Lord will take the prophet if he starts to lead us astray. I'm not sure that we really want to stick by this if we look at the history of our prophets for the last seven prophets that we've had. I mean, the last 6 years of most of their administrations have been in a state of, you know, either they're comatose or they're not able to function. Does this mean that the Lord is taking the prophet? Is this what we are really supposed to... When Harold B. Lee died after only 15 months in office, was this a statement... are we to interpret this that the Lord, that he was leading the church astray and the Lord took him? I mean, you know, when we think about what we're actually saying in order to palliate one another's feelings and give ourselves certainty about our church structure, I think if we look into these things, a lot of them don't hold up. So, again, I think we have sentimentality being asserted over sense, and that's, I think, what I object to.
I think to have an example of something isn't necessarily asserting sentimentality. When to say that President Benson couldn't have ever had any input during this period and the other brethren were leading it totally on their own without any input at all. I think is an awfully bold assertion, and unless you were there all the time, I don't see how you can make it, Paul. Sure, but that could well be. That could well be. Now, was that done with the authority of President Benson? I don't know. Which of the things is that required?
Well, I think so.
Well, I know you've asserted that. I don't know where it says that. I don't know where any revelation has ever said that. And that's fine to assert it. I think that. That's fine. That's a personal belief. And in stating a personal belief, that's perfectly legitimate. To say that's church standard, I don't know that that's there. But also in any organization that you have, I mean, we talk a lot about what the President of the United States is doing. Hopefully he's lucid most of the time. But clearly he's not involved in all of those decisions. Those are his underlings, and the things are being issued in his name, the same as they are in any company. I don't see that as being unusual. Would it be good if we had a president of the church that was all the time up on it and lucid and able to get up in conference and speak clearly and pound on the pulpit and be 38 years away? I think that'd be great. And if there's some way to pull it off, that'd be wonderful. And I'd sustain that too. But that doesn't, you know, I mean, to take and wash all that away, just by saying it's sentimental, Paul, I don't think that washes.
It is, and I think it doesn't make it any better. I'm not calling for so much a change in the church organization, just honesty. That's all.
Issue 4. The president is dead. Long live the president. For years, Howard W. Hunter has given beautiful, Christ-centered, honest talks. In May of this year, at age 86, he became president of the church. What will his administration bring? On June 6, 1994, he made a statement to the press in which he said, among other things, the following, and I quote, "To those who have transgressed or been offended, we say, come back. To those who are hurt and struggling and afraid, we say, let us stand with you and dry your tears. To those who are confused and assailed by error on every side, we say, come to the God of all truth and the Church of Continuing Revelation. Come back. Stand with us. Carry on. Be believing. All is well, and all will be well. Feast at the table, lay Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and strive to follow the Good Shepherd who has provided it." Close quote. Question. What changes, if any, can we expect to see in a Hunter administration?
Well, I would hope that one change that he could make, and only he can make, I think, is some kind of change in what to do when a president becomes incapacitated. Once the president is incapacitated, it's very hard to make a policy like that. I think the only person that can make a policy like that is a prophet who is functioning and in office. And I would hope that he would see the need that the church has for something like that. Whether his influence will extend any further is problematic, in my opinion. He started out well. That initial statement was like dew from heaven on this valley. It felt so good. But the excommunications continue. The discipline continues. The havoc continues. My feeling is that he obviously has the right kind of soul for doing good things, whether he's got the energy and the strength to battle the bureaucracy below him, or whether he's even getting accurate information, I think is something to be considered. One thing that I think will help is that his words are extremely moving, and they are very beautiful. I'm looking at my last issue of the Ensign, which has an extensive quote from him on the end, that it's just Sunstone couldn't say it better. God's chief way of acting is by persuasion and patience and long-suffering, not by coercion and stark confrontation. He acts by gentle solicitation and by sweet enticement. He always acts with unfailing respect for the freedom and independence that we possess. He wants to help us and pleads for the chance to assist us, but he will not do so in violation of our agency. to countermand and ultimately forbid our choices was Satan's way, not God's, and the Father of us all simply will never do that. He will, however, stand by us forever to help us see the right path, find the right choice, respond to the true voice, and feel the influence of his undeniable spirit. His gentle, peaceful, powerful persuasion to do right and find joy will be with us so long as time shall last, or the earth shall stand, or there shall be one man upon the face thereof to be saved. That kind of stuff really gets me. And I'm hoping that it will really get some other people too, because the president of the church is quoted, and he has beautiful quotes. I'm really hoping that maybe his words alone, being published and read, will calm things down.
I'm going to argue that it's not going to make many changes. First of all, because I remember when President Benson became prophet, his first speech was just as loving. It also, in spite of the fact that there had not been any excommunications at the time, issued a kind of welcome for people who had been away or dissidents or who were unhappy. It was a beautifully written speech, and President Benson has written some beautifully articulated and eloquent speeches. So I'm not sure whether this is a change, because we now have a prophet who can speak in that beautiful way. Secondly, President Hunter's admonition to those who differ to come back is still couched in the same definition that has been causing these people to be excommunicated. Let me just read here from his statement. He said, "Popularity is not the basis for teaching certain doctrines, though some feel that popularity makes them right." Now, in no way do feminists, intellectuals, and homosexuals who are trying to approach the church for some kind of reconciliation deserve to be characterized as people who think that popularity justifies the reasons behind their concerns over those issues. But that is the way the church has traditionally discarded these concerns. And so I see again a change, no change at all. If, in fact, though, President Hunter continues to say this over and over again, based on propaganda theory, if we hear it often enough, maybe people will be nicer to us because of him.
Issue 5, cracks in the temple. We have seen in the past year demonstrations of historic proportions. Spray painting and placards at BYU, hymn singing vigils at disciplinary councils, the Olive Branch ad and the Academic Freedom ad. Large ads in the Salt Lake Tribune, and did they run in the Deseret News? We've seen so-called Sunday gatherings with hymn singing, talks, and even Sunday school classes. Other groups have formed in our meeting. And here, the aspirational gospel described at the Sunstone Symposium seems to bear less and less relation to the actual hierarchical structure of the church proper. Question: on a scale of 1 to 10, how deep is the rift between church leadership and the alternate or dissident or liberal or intellectual wing of the church? 1 being these are natural growing pains, 10 being we're seeing the beginning of a schism.
In 1852, when Brigham Young announced publicly announced plural marriage, one of the brethren came to him all excited and said, "Now you've really let the cat out of the sack." And he turned to him and said, "Brother, you just don't understand. There are unnumbered cats in that sack." I think there has always been in the church, if you look back to the very earliest days, there has always been dissension. Sometimes it's been very, very sharp. You've had a lot of people split off and move off in their new directions, different directions. You've had people that have been lost from the general councils of the church, from the general authorities. You've had periods of relative peace. I think we're seeing a part of this. We're seeing continuation of the same stream that's flowed before. I would anticipate that in the future there's going to be a period when things will come together again, and then they're going to come apart again. I don't think that this lifetime was the time that was intended that we would find peace.
1 to 10. Need a number. 10 is we're on the brink of schism. 1 is these are just some more natural growing things.
I think all of the above. They say that a lawyer's national flower is the hedge.
I see some evidence of schism. I'm going to say 8 anyway, because at least through the email communities that are developing, I'm on an email network for feminists, and we already have our own bishop. We feel like a ward. Lynn Anderson. Bishop Lynn Anderson. She's very fair. We sort of made her our bishop. It's not official, but in a sense, she does take that act, and we consider ourselves a ward simply because somebody said, hey, we're kind of like a ward. That's where I get a lot of the spiritual nourishment that I need and the kind of community that I need. This is like a little world unto myself that, in a sense, is a schism. Nobody knows, really, but it's a very real world. So I'd say that in some ways, this will continue, and there will be perhaps two churches, in a sense.
Doug, I'm going to assign your answer a number 3, so, unless you disagree, and we have an 8.
I do disagree. There are those for whom it's a 10, very clearly. And there are those in the church for whom it's a 1.
5.5.
My concern...
5.5.
My concern in signing a number is the problem that I think we all tend to have, that the world begins and ends with us.
That's what we're here for.
Yeah. Years ago I took a job in a large institution, and I was part of the administration. One of the other administration members used to say that the history of the facility was defined as before Doug Bates and after Doug Bates. Because in my speaking of that institution, I had no corporate memory of the previous time. Everything started with me and what I knew about it. That was my world, in the sense of this world will come to an end, as we read in the scriptures, now being the world for that time period. And in my particular circle, there might be a number that could be assigned to it. In Paul's, that you could assign a number to it. But to assign a number to it for the whole church, it's all of the above. It really is. I don't see a general split coming in the church as a whole. I see splits coming in parts of the church, but again, that's nothing new. If you go to the Godbeites or whatever, going all the way back to the beginning, you've had those splits. And groups have moved out and they've moved back in. And for those people, it's been very, very serious. It's probably been for the church too, but people haven't known about it. But those people that were directly involved, certainly it was a 10.
How do you feel?
How do I personally feel? It wasn't where I was. It's where the church is. Where am I personally? What do I think? So far as I myself am concerned, I think the church is going to move forward, and we're going to see people moving in and out of it. And I'm going to try and stay within the church. So maybe a 3. I don't know.
The answer is 3.
I would probably put it at about a 6. I was picked for this panel because I'm a moderate. Most people who know me would find that pretty funny, but I did find that I scored on the orthodoxy test many of you have taken. I scored a 43. Which was interesting to me. That was more orthodox than I would have thought I scored. I think that in order, you know, I think what people want if they're going to break off from the church is a viable alternative. And I don't think that we've got a viable alternative. I think what we're seeing here is a massive reaction against the hierarchical church, but it's not for something else. I mean, most religions or schisms that are successful form around a charismatic person or a fabulous new idea. I think most people in the church, even people here, likely would prefer to see things stay the way they are with things lightening up. I myself would prefer to stay in the church and be supplemented by Sunstone. What I am deathly afraid of, to tell you the truth, is that the attacks by the institutional church on groups such as Sunstone will eliminate gradually, or maybe more precipitously, the moderate element that I have always valued here. My goal for Sunstone, myself personally, is that it be a place that will help me stay in the institutional church. I don't really want to leave. And every time there's another outrageous excommunication, I ask myself, as probably many of you do, is this going to be the thing that is going to force me out? So far, I've managed to stay in, and I would prefer to do that, and I think most people would. Maybe I'm wrong. But I think that we need the right to supplement our religious experience outside of the regular channels.
I scored 44 on the orthodoxy test. So much for that test. Maybe it was the neo-orthodoxy test. I don't know. I give it a 1. I don't think it's going to split, and the reason why is because those people who are tired of it are too tired to reorganize. If they're going to leave, they're just going to vaporize into the general American culture and try to have home churches or something, but that won't work because they're at home and you're tired of that too, and you'll just probably go to the library after a while, then to the rest home, and then... Then you die, and you can face God and sort it all out with God. As for fundamentalists who always seem to have a superior amount of energy, that is, people who are able to have some of the energy to take the scriptures literally all the time, really do have the energy to organize, and they will. But usually what I experience with these, and I have a lot of sympathy for the people who are in these things, I have no judgment, but my experience of watching this happen and knowing people in it is that usually the charismatic figure is just not quite charismatic enough and burns the candles at both ends, and people, by going by a circuitous loop, those people also wind up in the public library. And then in the rest home, talking to the rest of us who went there. So I think the church, which managed to get through the accommodation period, and then thanks to, actually it was President Tanner, who put the church on a sound financial footing, has I think ensured the future is with the power structure, and it will kind of go barreling on until... The only thing I think could self-destruct it is the discovery of self-dealing on the part of the leadership with respect to money. And if that ever were to come to light, I don't have any evidence of it, and I'm not making any allegations or anything like that. I'm just saying as a hypothetical matter that would be something that might throw it off track. But I think there's a big, heavy train on tracks, and it's moving at a great speed. And the thing that's... Fred is the one who says this. I'm going to quote Fred. The thing that makes the... changes or even the disruption of the ongoing progress of the Mormon ecclesiastical institution is its success. Hey, it's not that there are just 6 people disciplined or 120 or however you want to count it. It's that we have 9 million members and people flocking to get in all over the world, and then we have this carping group at Sunstone every August who gets together, and look at the success we're having. I mean, how can you people at Sunstone be arguing with success? Thousands and thousands of people are joining this church, and their lives are upgraded by the experience all over the world. And you're worrying about a little piddly thing like unrighteous dominion. Come on. Paul wins. The answer was 1. Issue number 6. Enter to serve, go forth to learn. Think about it. Is academic freedom alive at BYU? David Knowlton, an anthropologist and scholar of Mormon studies, was denied tenure in one of two highly publicized cases. Originally, the ground was stated to be scholarship. Later, the administration admitted that his citizenship, which is their term, was also a factor. In other words, I think his posture with respect to the church and the Board of Trustees. He had given a Sunstone paper on the church in South America. He appealed his denial of tenure, but his appeal was denied by Rex Lee. He, the last I have heard at least, is still contemplating possible litigation. The other highly publicized faculty firing was Cecilia Concher Farr, an English teacher and feminist. She was also denied tenure. She publicly took a pro-choice position in remarks at a rally, which was later published. She settled with BYU while her case was on appeal. Some have suggested that BYU is becoming a seminary. Do you have confidence that the Knowlton and Farr cases were handled honestly and fairly? First part of the question. Second part, can BYU maintain its mission of integrating the academic and the spiritual?
Well, to answer question number one, I'd have to ask myself, would underlings in the hierarchy lie to cover up the sense that people have that these two people were denied tenure for political actions? Would they do that? And I think that because of the way the nature of hierarchy, I would think that they very well might. So because of that, I think we all kind of know that. So there's an atmosphere of fear that's going to be developing there. And outside BYU, I attend an outside university, and I talk to a lot of people, and BYU is not particularly well received in terms of scholarship by those people that are aware of this scandal, if you want to call it such. So, and any kind of fear you get to respond to the notion of are they going to integrate spirituality? There's no spirituality when there's fear. So my feeling is that no.
If the question were, was it well handled, I think absolutely not. If the question, you know, if we were to say, was that unique, I got my PhD from the University of Kansas. My major professor had some ideas that were considered heretical in the psychology area. Even though he was brought to the facility and given full professorship with tenure because they needed his name in order to get some huge grants, which they then did. And then they told their students they couldn't attend his classes. He had to drive from Kansas City to Lawrence and go to a student's home after dark so the students could come over there and listen to him, because he couldn't. Those students couldn't be seen coming to that house to hear him speak. And that's not unique. BYU has some buzz areas that are sensitive that we all know, and it creates some rather interesting distortions in fair play, perhaps, or in due process as we think it ought to operate. But it's certainly not unique. And is that going to harm BYU among people that aren't LDS? Yeah, but I think BYU is going to be harmed among people that aren't LDS anyway, simply because they're LDS. I think the whole situation was unfortunate, and I think it was poorly handled.
Well, I also agree that it was poorly handled, and it was another example of how the official stance is something different than what really happened. It's just, you know, I regard it as a cover-up, and all of the negative comments that were made on scholarship and peer review publishing, I just found it infuriating myself, really. As to whether BYU can continue its mission, I didn't go to BYU. I have a son who's there, and I guess the only way I was able to rationalize it is that he seems to be going into engineering and physics, and I figured there's no Mormon version of calculus. And so that's why I can feel comfortable. He did, as a freshman, however, get into Reed Benson's Book of Mormon class, and I made him transfer out. I told him over my dead body I would never write another board and room check again if he didn't transfer. So he took my advice and did. So I feel that, you know, as long as I sort of maintain some oversight of things, we might get through. He's had a wonderful time. Again, it's, as Paul has said, it's hard to argue with success. BYU is bulging at the seams. Everybody in the whole world wants to go there. And frankly, my kid had a terrific time. But, you know, 19, 18 is young to realize the implications of academic freedom. And I regret that he's going to miss some of that.
Somewhere in here, I have my card from BYU. I have a master's degree from there. And when this happened, I looked at it and I said, what is this going to be worth in the academic community as an alumni if they don't straighten up and have a real university? I didn't go there with the idea that it was a seminary. I went there because all of their material coming out of there was that this was a real university and you could go there and you were going to be on an equal footing. Am I right? Equal footing with other universities, because we were going to be, and now they put it in different terms about being the Harvard of the West. And in some respects, I think that might be have a horrible irony to it. But the reality is that when they do this, this card, the graduation, is an becomes an embarrassment. You don't want to tell people that you're graduated from BYU or you hold a master's degree in literature from there, because people are going to judge you maybe not by what standards you got your degree under, but what's in the current press now. And it's very bad to do this. But they don't care about the alumni, and they don't really care about the students. This is not about that. This is about control. And incidentally, this card, you can't drown it, and you can't burn it, because I tried. And it has no known use. Can I put it in there? A second point I want to make, and that has to do with the quote that the lovely quote that she read from President Hunter. Now, I love President Hunter. I've always respected him, and I don't have a thing to say about him that's negative. He's a wonderful man. But the text that he gave, which is beautiful when read in a bright context, can be used to suppress dissent. Because not all of us speak gently. Not all of us have a sweet temperament. And sometimes language like this can be subverted from its proper purpose, which was by President Hunter, I think, to encourage people to feel the Spirit of the Lord and do the Lord's will, which I concur with. That very language could be subverted from its original purpose and used to say, gee, Paul, you're angry. President Howard W. Hunter has said to be gentle. We cannot listen to you until you're gentle. You see how the text can be used? Husbands, wives, submit to your husbands. Egotistical maniacs and be battering you like hell. You submit because it's in the scripture. See? So any text, the words of Jesus himself, can be subverted and used to promote a kind of tyranny, spiritual tyranny. And that's the problem, is that the text never exists outside of the context of the Holy Spirit. Now, in the BYU affair, there were many texts, many words. You have to sift through a mountain of procedure and data to sort out what happened. But the real question is, what was the ultimate purpose of all of that? Was it to level the playing field, increase spirituality, open discussion, trust people, allow for participation? Or was it just to narrow categories and get a problem solved and get rid of some people who seem to be posing a problem without having to think about what they said? Well, I was there during the Wilkinson administration, and I can smell it. It smells pretty much similar, and it's a bad odor. It's not food. You know, and those of you who think it is need to have some kind of therapy, because it isn't. But it doesn't mean that everybody involved is bad, and it doesn't mean that the text or the procedures are necessarily bad, but you can subvert all of those things, even though they're good, to very bad purposes. And those things can be subverted by people like Bruce Hafen, who is a good man. I like him. I've met with him. I know him. And yet, maybe if a person, as a very good person, thinks that there is a higher purpose that we have to do this now in order to achieve a higher purpose, the purity of doctrine, the purity of the church, the protection of our children, the growth of testimonies. We can fudge a little on this because we really have a higher purpose. Thomas More said, the person who violates his own conscience for policy leads his country or whatever it is on the short road to chaos. I think that problem happens over and over again in an organization.
Issue 7. Elder Ballard is the talk of the nation. In June of this year, Elder Russell M. Ballard, or M. Russell Ballard, appeared on Talk of the Nation, a nationally broadcast radio call-in show. How many of you were aware of that? Can I see by a show of hands? Okay. Okay, maybe 15% of the audience. Ray Suarez, the moderator, asked, Elder Ballard, is it unusual for you to be on a national talk show like this one and take callers that you don't know in advance what they're going to ask from around the country? Question, true or false, to the panel. The appearance of an apostle on a nationally broadcast radio talk show fielding unscreened questions from the general public was unprecedented. True or false?
True.
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 I don't listen to talk shows. I don't know.
Elder Ballard's answer was this. Quote, well, a little bit. I've done some of it in the past. I think it's a nice thing to be able to respond and answer questions and try to clarify points of view. A number of issues were discussed on that program. Unfortunately, our time is running short. There's only one that I'm going to pose to the panel. One caller asked about the Mormon Church's position with respect to women, and this was Elder Ballard's answer. I don't know of any organization on the face of the earth that holds women in higher esteem than does the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The leader of every Mormon home, if the priesthood leader is thinking straight, is the mother and the father. They lead together in the home. It's an absolute partnership in shepherding and caring for their children. My question to the panel is, in the church generally, are priesthood leaders thinking straight?
Again, it's asking for a global question. I think there are real problems because each of us brings with us the heritage of the time in which we were born. If you were to take a slice of the younger people, I think you're going to find a much more egalitarian or accepting or partnership attitude than you will among those that were born several years ago and raised in an early period. Do men tend to exercise unrighteous dominion? I think yes. And have the teachings of the church as they have traditionally been absorbed by people supported that and reinforced it? I think yes. Is it changing? I hope so. I think it is.
I'm gonna say something very favorable about Mormon men. I think that in practice, Mormon men understand the concerns of feminism, and they don't really cause a problem in practice. But they still speak the party line, and as do many women. It's not a matter of people's bad behavior to their wives. It's a matter of a kind of philosophy that's current in the church today. There's been some changes in the philosophy. It used to be that you never said women were equal. It was part of common rhetoric to say that women were not equal. Now it's part of common rhetoric to say that they're equal, and the church has followed right along. But in terms of Mormon men dominating their wives, we have about the same, it appears to me we have about the same statistical rates of wife abuse, if you want to get into that sort of thing. You don't want to get into that sort of thing, do you, Fred? As the rest of the world. But I think that Mormon men, on the whole, are wonderful companions and that they do not abuse their wives. Many Mormon men are feminists who have added substantially to the cause of Mormon women in, as they seek to be seen as equal and to gain a greater voice in the church.
Thank you, Sonia. I appreciated that. I think what bothers me about that is the same thing that probably bothers most of you, and that is that the determination, the ultimate determination of the atmosphere in the home seems to rest with the priesthood leader thinking straight. If the priesthood leader isn't thinking straight, there doesn't seem to be any license granted to the woman in the house to do the straight thinking instead. Her only alternative seems to be to suffer through it. It's just another way of making it sound equal, but it's not.
And behind the language of equality lie these terrifying metaphors of partnership and leader and priesthood leader that are being imposed upon a relationship between a man and a woman, that certainly there must be other ways of talking about that relationship other than invoking what I consider corporate or military metaphors, which I think betray more about what they're telling us than the actual words would seem to imply. I think that Brother Ballard was not honest. I think the message of the church is that men lead, women follow, except in those menial areas or domestic areas where the men have no interest. And that has been the long tradition in Mormonism. It is the tradition today. It is what they would like us to do. However, economic realities are such that it is not the leadership and revelation that has brought about equality, but economic necessity.
We've been here a long time. I want to save at least a little bit of time for questions. I've got two more brief questions to the panel. I'm looking for one-sentence responses. On the same radio show, Albert Peck, who also appeared as to Jan Shipps, made the following statement when the question arose as to what are the most important issues facing the church today. Quote, "I don't think the most important issues facing the church are the things my magazine deals with, the intellectual scholarly issues. We occasionally can give insight and put a spotlight on certain issues. But the greatest issues are the challenge that come from being a successful religion. They are the challenge that comes from growth and the demands of learning how to carry Mormonism and not Americanism into other cultures, and the demand for raising up leadership in new developing areas, the demand to finance a vibrant church in underdeveloped countries, and the demand to decentralize and keep a strong faith among the members." In a sentence, what is the most important issue facing the church today?
I agree that it's growth, the growth of idolatry.
I think the church's greatest issue is keeping from standing in the way of people's spirituality.
I think the issue facing the church today is the morality of the people, in that they learn to tell the truth to themselves and face hard issues.
I think it's growth, because when you're trying to manage a large institution, you tend to homogenize and compress rather than permit a flowering of a lot of individuality. And I think a lot of the problems that have brought you here have been a reflection of the growth. And this is only one sentence because it's got a lot of clauses.
Now I'm going to ask the panel to prove President Gordon B. Hinckley wrong. In 1983, at the Women's Conference, the September Churchwide Women's Conference, he made the statement, quote, "None of us can foretell the future," close quote. My question to the panelists, again, one-sentence responses, give us a prediction for the coming year.
I didn't realize it was going to be one sentence.
Well, we're running out of time. You can make it.
I predict more disciplinary councils will be held.
Well, I have the ridiculous and the sublime. I predict that Chieko Okazaki will fail to stand when an apostle enters the room, And as penance, we'll have to co-author a book with Boyd Packer entitled Straighten Up. The other one is that significant change, I predict that significant change in the church will not come from the headquarters, but will come from the diaspora. The church outside of the Wasatch Front is going to force changes that are necessary in the church.
I predict that I'll be excommunicated for the mean things I said about Elder Packer on this panel.
I think the members of the church are going to be overjoyed to have a prophet stand up and speak in conference again instead of having an old speech read.
Thank you very much. That was 1993, 94 in Mormonism. We have about 5 minutes for questions to the panel. Yes. The question is, there was a reference to the remarkable tolerance of the leaders of the church. Why at one particular moment did that tolerance break?
Why is there the perception that these three groups that were mentioned are dangerous?
And why the perception that the three groups are dangerous?
Well, I think the tolerance broke partly because of the vacuum that had been created, but also because... the church had finally discovered a method for being able to get rid of dissidents, and that is the method of changing to disciplinary councils rather than courts, and then setting up a false standard of don't do this, and if you do, we'll excommunicate you. And so basically the reason is they found a way. Prior to that, they exercised tolerance because they had to. Now, maybe that's not tolerance, which means I was wrong in my previous statements, and I'm greatly ashamed. The second one was the reason for the three particular groups that Elder Packer spoke against is just that those are there's a tremendous surge to hate those three groups in the common feeling of the country. Those are three target groups that are commonly and even historically attacked. When we feel that the family is falling apart, or when social changes come, those are scapegoats that we commonly use.
Any other questions? Yes. The question was, how is it that no one mentioned Section 121 as a guide to marriage, in marriage, as to the way husbands and wives treat one another?
Murphy's Law, Book 3, has a statement of wisdom on that, and it says, never attribute to malice that which can be adequately explained by stupidity, and I think we just didn't have your wisdom.
Yes.
How many church leaders in the coming general conference will...
Question was, how many church leaders in general conference this year will sound the theme that President Hunter has opened of love and compassion?
I don't think very many will, and I'll tell you very briefly a story. Back a few years ago when President Benson was active, he gave a speech, and it must have been April conference in the priesthood session. And when he got up, it was very hot in there, and he took off his coat. And he said, I invite all of you to take off your coats. And everybody, all the brethren, took off their coats, but not the general authorities. And a friend of mine asked a general authority as to why they didn't take off their coats. And the answer was because Boyd K. Packer did not take off his coat.
One more question. Yes. Question is, in view of two things, one is an apparent lack of respect by the members toward the general authorities, and secondly, a lack of respect toward the general authorities' position on women, does anyone on the panel foresee a schism between the leadership and the membership of the church?
I do not foresee a schism. I have seen nothing in my ward, which I guess is an average ward, especially more average now that we're missing Paul. Please come back. My feeling.
To be below average.
No, I want somebody at my back when I go into battle here. My feeling is that what we're not seeing is so much a schism as reality that the general authorities are not in touch with. And the main reality that I think they're not in touch with is the situation of women as we really are. Lessons continue to be taught on how we're to stay in the home when, in fact, the majority of us are working outside of the home. Lessons continue to be taught putting us in a certain role. And if you were to poll the women in the room, that role applies to almost none of them. So I don't see so much a schism as just a reality gap, especially on the issue of women, with the leaders in the church. That's why I really think that events outside of the church will shape church policy more than the general authorities themselves.
Thank you all for coming, and God bless you.